evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Turkish president says murder of Jamal Khashoggi was planned and calls for extradition of Saudi suspects. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said today that the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi was a planned and brutal murder and called on Saudi Arabia to extradite 18 suspects to Turkey to face justice for the crime. He promised to reveal the naked truth about Jamal Khashoggi's death, but did not. What happened? For insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. Daniel, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me.
First, your thoughts on President Erdogan's revelation of the naked truth or not?
Well, he's playing a very delicate game. I think the ultimate objective is to dislodge Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince. I think Erdogan wants him out of there. And his other goal is to demote Saudi Arabia. I think he's kind of, wants to assert his authority as the regional kingpin and also as the preeminent Islamic power in the world. So I think he's pursuing two or three objectives simultaneously, and I think he's doing a pretty good job of it, too, I must say.
To dislodge MDS, why the drip, 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 or no pun intended, death by a thousand cuts? Why not just release what is there for the world to see if he has what he had, what he claims to have?
Well, he's playing a delicate game. He doesn't want to harm Salman, King Salman, but he wants Salman to either demote or fire essentially his son. He doesn't want to wreak havoc in Saudi Arabia, but he wants to definitely put it in its place. So he's applying the pressure gradually. He's gradually ratcheting it up.
And do you think that he runs the possibility of overplaying his hand?
In what way?
Well, the longer he drags this out, it's possible then he could lose control of the objective that he's trying to achieve.
Well, I think he holds all the cards. The Saudis have. I mean, this operation, the murder of a Khashoggi, the correct pronunciation, I believe, is. It's just a monumentally stupid, botched operation, completely incompetent. I mean, really as embarrassing as it was brutal. So he has all the cards. I mean, the Saudis are really at his mercy. So I don't think there's much danger of overplaying his hands, but he definitely wants to control the pace of events.
CIA Director Gina Haspel has been sent to Turkey on behalf of Donald Trump. Why do you think Trump is sending Bloody Gina, as she has become known?
Because he wants to find out what Erdogan is up to. He wants to find out what the facts are, and Erdogan wants to share that with the U.S. Erdogan wants to make sure the U.S. is apprised of what's going on, that it understands what Turkey is up to. Erdogan's a very smart guy. I've got a hand to the guy. I don't like him very much, but he's a smart guy. Mm-hmm. He wants to play this very carefully. He wants to make sure everyone's lined up, and he's asserting his authority. I mean, Turkey's had a wild ride in the last year. It screwed up royally in Syria. It backed the wrong side, essentially. Uh, it, it, economy is taking a pummeling. It's feuded with the U.S. It has made up with Russia after also feuding with Russia. But now I think Erdogan wants to use his case as leverage to sort of reassert his authority, to establish himself as the regional power, and to put his Saudi rivals in his place. And someone said that Erdogan is making a bid to control the Persian Gulf, and that's quite a prize. You know, whoever controls the Persian Gulf controls, you know, a major portion of the world's fossil fuel supplies. And it would certainly, catapult Turkey into the political big leagues.
How do you see him being able to accomplish that? Is that a pipe dream, or do you think that that's something he could actually accomplish?
No, I don't think it's a pipe dream at all. I think I think Saudi Arabia is rapidly fading. I think the House of Saud is in big trouble. I think that there are a number of scenarios you could engage in, but one possibility is a wholesale crumbling of that regime. I mean, if MBS, I mean, remember, MBS, or Mohammed bin Salman, as he's known, was brought in by his father to repair an economy that was in deep trouble in early 2015, and also to restore Saudi Arabia's international standing as Obama was entering to the final stages of negotiating his nuclear accord with Iran, and MBS royally blew both those tasks. The economy is completely on its back. The country is economically isolated, and politically it's toxic. So Saudi Arabia is in big trouble. Salman, appointed, just the worst guy, showed the worst judgment possible in giving near total power to his son. And now Saudi Arabia is in bigger trouble than ever. Now, maybe Salman can restore things by demoting his son, by firing his son, by bringing in some more stable members of the royal family to take over. There's talk about various candidates, but maybe he can't. Maybe things are so far out of control that the House of Saud, which is incredibly rotten and corrupt, will just crumble. And that's a distinct possibility. Remember what happened to Libya when Gaddafi was gotten out of the way. The country just crumbled into dust. And I think that's certainly a possibility as far as Saudi Arabia is concerned.
Now, that's an interesting comparison to draw between Libya and Saudi Arabia, because everything that you just said, not excluded, that the family is more stable, that it's a family business as opposed to an individual company, as with Libya. So by bringing in a replacement for MBS, the family is still stable, as opposed to the vacuum that was created when Gaddafi was executed.
That's absolutely correct. You're absolutely right. But sometimes things can be too stable. Saudi Arabia is a very stable country. It's been kind of frozen for decades on end.
Or as they say in physics, metastability. It appears to be so, but it actually is not.
And it's the royal family is huge. No one knows how many princes there are, but their estimates go as high as 7,000. The corruption is amazing, and it's just rotten. And that was why Salman brought. I mean, after Ibn Saud, the founder of the Saudi monarchy, died in 1953, six or seven of his sons ruled in succession, and each one was older, sicker, and more obese than the preceding one.
Mm-hmm.
And Salman is only intermittently lucid. He's reportedly has Alzheimer's. And clearly that second generation was at the end of the line. So Salman therefore decided to get the bright idea of bringing the third generation online by grooming his son, MBS, to become prince. And if things had gone well, MBS could have taken over the throne and ruled for half a century, which would have brought him to what? To the year 2070 or 2065?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it didn't work. And the regime is in big trouble. And I don't think there are the institutional reserves necessarily to put things back on an even keel.
You mentioned the toxicity of the House of Saud. And there's an article literally standing at a weapons show in Paris. Francis Macron says questions about arms sales to Saudis are off topic, sounding much more like U.S. President Donald Trump than German Chancellor Angela Merkel in terms of holding the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia even slightly to account for the recent murders of journalist Jamal Khashoggi or the ongoing carnage in Yemen. French President Macron on today refused to answer questions about his country's pending arms deals with the Saudis and told reporters to get used to it. So in spite of the toxicity, there still seems to be various levels of it, or a willingness, some level of tolerance, depending on the dollars that are on the table.
Yep, money talks, no question about it. And everyone still wants Saudi money. So maybe, you know, so there's some thought that maybe, you know, maybe in a few months they'll allow the thing, this whole thing, to cool down, and the old relationship will be restored. But I just don't think it's quite so easy. I don't think it's quite so easy. I think the regime, that the deep weakness of the Saudi regime has been exposed. They've lost immense credibility. Their standing has plummeted, and I don't think it's really quite possible to put this Humpty Dumpty back together again.
So compare Macron's answer about it's off the table, don't even bother asking me about it, to what's happening in the United States. On the one side, you've got Bolton, you've got Trump. I'm not sure where Pompeo is in the equation, versus Lindsey Graham and Lil Marco, who are demanding a whole lot more be done, or at least that's where they are right now. So compare and contrast, if you could, the politics of all of this in terms of France versus the politics of all of this in the United States.
Well, the big difference is Iran. I mean, France, Germany, the EU in general are quite happy with the nuclear accord with Iran. They want that to continue. Trump, of course, has declared war on the nuclear accord, wants to encircle Iran and put pressure on it, isolate it. And for that, he needs Saudi Arabia. Now, the Democrats and some Republicans like Rubio, are playing a double game. They also want to isolate Iran. They also want to, they want to line up on behind Trump's anti-Iranian crusade. But at the same time, they want to, make hay over the Saudis' latest difficulty. I mean, bear in mind, Saudi Arabia, that government is the most unpopular government on the face of the earth. They make North Korea seem like a bunch of liberals.
Mm-hmm.
They are hated. They have been in conflict with every one of their neighbors, with few exceptions. I mean, Yemen, Oman, Qatar, Bahrain, even the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, they have had conflicts with. And, of course, Syria. They have destroyed Syria by flooding it with jihadis and weapons. So this is a hated government. But Trump needs them, and I think that the Democrats and Republicans ultimately are behind Trump on this thing.
And so what is Erdogan's game with the U.S.? Now, you very clearly articulated the game that he's playing with Saudi Arabia, but what is his ploy or his play with the United States?
He wants to, U.S.-Turkish relations have been very troubled for a long time. Turkey accused the U.S. of backing the military coup against him, which he bloodily suppressed. The U.S. is harboring Gulen, the leader of what Erdogan regards as a deep anti-state conspiracy. So he wants to put U.S.-Turkish relations on a different footing, one in which Turkey, plays a stronger hand.
How does he play that hand? How does he repair the U.S.-Turkey relationship if he wants to unseat MBS, the United States wants to keep Saudi Arabia at the table and in very close friendship proximity to deal with Iran, how does Erdogan play those cards?
Well, you know, he turns the flames up a little bit. He turns the flames down a little bit. You know, as he roasts Salman on his, you know, so
on his own petard.
On his own petard. Do I turn the flames up? You know, and that makes the U.S. uncomfortable. Okay, the U.S. is uncomfortable. I'll appease Trump and I'll turn the flames down a bit. You know, but he has gotten for himself, you know, this wonderful instrument that is this deeply, you know, deeply disabled, you know, profoundly hurt Saudi regime, which he can then use as leverage to increase his own power and vis-a-vis not only the Saudis, but all the other players in the region. And that's first and foremost the U.S. You know, so, as I said, like, you know, he turns the heat up, he turns the heat down, you know, he turns the spit, so he roasts Salman on the other side. You know, so this is what he's doing, and as I said, it's not an unimpressive performance.
Going back to Gina Haspel, and I asked you why send her to Turkey? Why not send her to Saudi Arabia first?
Well, they already sent Pompeo to Saudi Arabia,
good point.
The Saudis are not going to. What are the Saudis going to tell them?
I know what they're going to tell him. That he died in a fist fight.
Yes, precisely. So, is MBS going to confess the truth? Of course not. But Erdogan has the good.
But see, I didn't really think, I never really thought that Pompeo went to Saudi to actually get the truth. I really thought that Pompeo went to Saudi to help him with the scam and the story.
I think you're right. I think, in fact, if you want the truth, Riyadh is the last place you would go.
There you go. So I think Pompeo went to say, okay, let me edit your statement before you make it.
I quite agree. But however, if you want the truth,
you got to go to Turkey.
Istanbul is the place to go.
Right. Okay.
And so therefore that they're sending Gina Haspel, and I presume, I don't know, I have no inside sources in this regard, but I presume that Erdogan will give her a deep, thorough briefing. Will lay all the evidence out before her so that it's quite clear, you know, where things stand.
And final question, we've got just about a minute. What do you think about Erdogan's admission that he bugged the consulate?
Well, I think that he had little choice.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, I think
Well, and also, it's really no secret. I mean,
yeah.
All the embassies assume that they're bugged. I mean, they're built in the they're built by the contractors, I believe, in the countries where they reside, most of them.
Yeah, so everyone knew it. So Erdogan, you know, it was a small admission on his part. He had no choice. He didn't lose much, and he still has he still is thoroughly in control.
So in 30 seconds, when all the dust settles, where's MBS?
Pretty sure the guy will be out.
Okay.
I can't see how he can carry on.
And what out means has yet to be determined, whether he's sent to the moon or who knows where.
The moon, sent to Morocco, sent to some villa somewhere, given some kind of no-show job in the provinces. I don't really know.
Gotcha.
I can't see how the guy can carry on.
Gotcha. Daniel Lazar, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Folks, you are listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more, a lot more, on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. U.S. President Donald Trump declared himself a nationalist at a Texas rally last night. And here is briefly what the president said.
A globalist is a person that wants the globe to do well, frankly, not caring about our country so much. And you know what? We can't have that. You know, they have a word. It sort of became old-fashioned. It's called a nationalist. And I say, really, we're not supposed to use that word. You know what I am? I'm a nationalist, okay? I'm a nationalist.
What does that mean, folks? Should we be concerned? To get insight into this, we turn to my next guest, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Jack, good evening, welcome, and thanks for coming on a Critical Hour.
Well, thanks for the invitation.
When you heard that statement from the president, what were your thoughts?
Well, my first thought was what he means by nationalist is someone who restores the country to some kind of prior greatness. You see, there's an external meaning to this and an internal meaning. The external reflects the view that the U.S. is somehow losing out its globally to competitors and is losing global control, you know, whether it's China or Russia restoring or the Third World or whatever. But there's an internal meaning, too, that appeals to his base, and that is that we're going to restore white supremacy over this challenge by people of color, you know, people from Latin America and Muslim folks and so forth. So nationalism means restoration to him, restoration of global power and global economic dominance by the U.S., and it means restoration of all these white folks who feel challenged. If you're a globalist, it means that you have no external enemy. You see, and this is where it's kind of frightening because it's similar to fascism. You know, you've got to have the enemy under fascism. The enemy within, of course, for Trump is the immigrant. And the enemy externally, of course, is these outside countries. You know, people forget that in Nazi Germany, the Jews were considered the immigrants. They somehow penetrated and settled in Germany, but they weren't part of the German nation. They were the enemy. Well, he's creating the immigrant from, you know, Latin America and elsewhere as the enemy within, and all these other countries are the enemy without. And now he's even expanding the meaning of enemy. He's talking about protesters, Americans, regardless of color, exercising their civil rights as, quote, the mob, you see. And he attacks the government, Hillary, and Pelosi vilifies political opponents personally. Well, that's exactly what Hitler did in Weimar Germany. The Stresemann government was, you know, he attacked them the way Trump uses Hillary and Pelosi and all the others. So there's, you know, some scary parallels going on here. Another scary parallel, I think, is that the way he really interacts with his supporters out there in giving these speeches, his supporters see him as someone who could do no wrong, the same way the Germans saw Hitler. He could do no wrong. You know, most of the Germans embraced Hitler more than they embraced Nazi ideology. And we see that same scary thing happening here.
Based upon his charisma.
Yes, yes. We see the same kind of a connection between, and he plays it very well in his speeches. You know, he loves it. He plays into it, and they play into him and everything. It's, you know, go watch some of the some of Hitler's early speeches, you know, in the early 1920s. And there's that same kind of chemical connection there. So, you know, globalism means you don't have external enemies within or enemy without, but nationalism means you're going to have an enemy. It's the immigrants and it's these other countries, and that's what's scary.
But Jack, there are those who would say, oh, Dr. Rasmus, you're taking this way too far. There are all types of nationalism. There's religious nationalism. There's economic nationalism. There's ethnic nationalism. Why do you have to go so to such the extreme and bring in the H word, using Hitler and the F word in terms of fascism? You're just putting words in Donald Trump's mouth.
Well, I don't care about all the academic definitions of nationalism. All I care is Trump's definition or meaning of nationalism. And you can't deny that he's got an internal enemy and he's got an external enemy, and he's attacking them and using them as a means to increase his power and his authority. Very clear. And clearly this guy thinks he's above the law. He's said as much that if he is indicted or anything by the Mueller investigation, he's going to pardon himself. Well, that's a tyrant. A tyrant is someone who thinks he's above the law. And I think he thinks he's above the law as far as this investigation is concerned. So there's a lot of parallels here. You know, I'm not saying that he's a fascist, but his nationalism is taking him on the road towards that conclusion, I think. You can't deny the historical parallels in the behavior that's going on right now by Trump and by his supporters. We are drifting in that direction right now, and I'm worried that after these November elections, I know Steve Bannon and Breitbart have all these plans to mobilize their supporters out there if protests and the Democrats go after Trump, and we may see his supporters attacking people protesting Trump or civil liberties in the streets. That's the next step.
Many cases in the courtroom are built upon more circumstantial evidence than direct evidence. Is it bad circumstantial evidence, or is it a coincidence that last night at this rally, as there's the migrant caravan coming through Mexico towards the United States, that Donald Trump decides to invoke nationalism into his hyperbolic rhetoric last night?
Oh, I don't think it's an accident at all. You know, this whole economic nationalism, and then it becomes anti-immigrant nationalism, proved well for him in the 2016 elections. It probably put him over the top, and he's playing that card again. Doubling down on it, isn't he, in the midterm elections. And he'll play it even more when it comes to the 2020 elections because it's worked for him.
Now, there are those who will say that, Dr. Rasmus, no, Donald Trump, even though he used the word nationalism, he's actually just talking about patriotism. He's just a patriot. He wants to make America great again. Why is that argument flawed?
Well, because if it's just a short step from saying, if you're a nationalist like me, you're not a globalist, you have an internal and external enemy, you're a nationalist, these people are preventing us from being great again, right? And you identify nationalism with patriotism, and it logically follows very quickly that if you're not a nationalist like him, you're not a patriot. And if you're not a patriot, then it's one step to say you're a traitor. Well, isn't he saying that about Hillary Clinton and the Democrats, that they're traitors? These people aren't traitors.
And also, I think a difference between nationalism and patriotism, nationalism has an element of superiority in its context. As a nationalist, my culture is better than, is superior to your culture. Whereas a patriot, you love your country, but you don't infuse in that love of your country superiority over those who are different from you. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say, but what you're really describing is there's several definitions of nationalism and several definitions of patriotism. What Trump has embraced is a specific definition of nationalism with enemies, and therefore he identifies that with patriotism. In other words, a select definition of patriotism, as you just pointed out.
You mentioned Steve Bannon, who we know is Donald Trump's alter ego and his intellectual guru. Bannon, in recent speeches, he continues to talk about the little guy versus the elite. And I'm trying to figure out, with as much wealth as Donald Trump is alleged to have, at least on paper, how Donald Trump can draw this parallel or this distinction between the elite and the little man as though he's not a part of the elite class.
Well, he can't, but he does, you know, and that's another parallel with Nazism. You know, they appeal to the working class with identifying, you know, the capitalists, the bankers who had played a role in the destruction of the German economy, and that played very well with a lot of the working class folks. And he's doing the same. Of course, the problem with Trump is that he's clearly part of that that banker, shadow banker, investment wheeler dealer class. You see, so it kind of makes it hard for him to sell that one. That's why, you know, it isn't quite fascism yet, but there are some scary parallels on the road to that actually happening in the U.S. that we ought to be very, very careful about. You know, really oppose. I mean, when he proposes nationalism and identifies enemies, immigrants as the enemy, and when he calls Hillary and the others, and I'm not a Hillary supporter, but when he calls those folks over there, Democrats, as traitors and lock them up, indict them, all that kind of stuff, then he's gone too far.
My guest is Dr. Jack Rasmus, a political economist and professor of economics and politics at St. Mary's College in Moraga, California. Jack, thanks so much for coming on board and staying with me. So as a political economist, and we've talked about this before, when we're looking at these tax cuts and who benefited and who's suffering behind these tax cuts, and you have those who are now talking about the social safety net and cutting social programs, as Donald Trump draws the distinction between himself as the proponent of the little guy and the elites, it's those who seem to be or going to be suffering the most from his cuts that are providing him the staunchest support. And this reminds me of the book, What's the Matter with Kansas? I'm drawing a blank on the author. This draws me right back to What's the Matter with Kansas? Thomas Frank, and What's the Matter with Kansas?
Well, that book really pointed to the fact that people can be blind to their own self-interest if you have a strong enough appeal and argument that diverts them from looking at their own self-interest. And that's, of course, what all this about the enemy within and the enemy without, his definition of nationalism, is all about. In other words, distract people from the real issues, and you can pretty much impose any policy you want. And the tax cuts are a good example. $4 trillion in tax cuts for businesses, investors, and bankers. That's what was passed earlier this year, and a $2 trillion increase on the taxes on the rest of us, on the middle class. And yet it was sold as it's going to generate more jobs. Well, now the facts are coming out. It's not generating any jobs. What is generated is a $1 trillion deficit every year and rising interest rates to pay for that deficit. And what that means now, we're going to have these huge deficits. Now he's going to use that as a hammer to go after Social Security and Medicare and education and so forth. This is all planned, by the way, not just Donald Trump, but, with McConnell and all the other guys on the Republican right in Congress.
Could the tax cuts have made more sense if they had not been followed by a $619 billion defense budget?
Well, the defense budget was raised at the same time, $100 billion a year, and it's going to keep going up as they lost a couple hundred billion dollars in taxes. Corporate taxes are down like $300 billion or something, the corporate income tax. That's what's created this huge $800 to $1 trillion deficit, national deficit that's going to add to the debt. We're looking at deficits of $1 trillion a year for the next 10 years, if there's no recession, and then it will be even more. That's why the Federal Reserve is raising rates, because it's got to borrow money by raising rates more to pay for this huge deficit.
And we know that Christine Lagarde at the IMF is warning of not a recession, but a looming depression.
Well, I've predicted that in the second half of next year, we will be in a recession in the U.S., very, very clearly here. How severe, no one really knows at the moment, but the rising rates to pay for the Trump deficit, to pay for the business tax cuts is going to hit home. It's going to come home. And we can already see the stock market beginning to realize this and getting very shaky here. So, you know, it's on the near horizon. It's coming. And that will exacerbate the deficit even more. And that will give the McConnells and the others even more ammunition to say we got to cut spending on social welfare and Social Security and Medicare and all the rest.
But just yesterday, President Trump said that his administration and the Republican Party are working to introduce a major 10% tax cut for the middle class beginning in November. Now, I know he's saying that with Congress not being in session. Is he just babbling, or this seem would only seem to exacerbate the exacerbation that you just talked about?
Well, you're not gonna see that tax cut. That's all midterm elections hoopla. That's what that is. There's no chance of that being passed, and he knows it. But it sells good to the troops out there in you know, in the rural land.
So, how concerned are you? Not so much about Trump's xenophobic rhetoric, but how it's resonating within his base.
Well, that's very scary because it is resonating. You see, what we've had after the 2008-09 crash is a very slow, uneven recovery. Corporations, stock markets, and the wealthy, the top 10%, have recovered very well. But if you look at what's still going on in the hinterland, in the midland, and a lot of other places on the coast, it's very, very weak recovery, and people are reacting to that very weak recovery. The post-2008 crash has left them behind, and they haven't really been restored. Main Street is still lagging. So the conditions for him to go out there and identify enemies within and without still exist. And he's playing to that very well. And that's not unlike what happened in Weimar Germany, you see, after 1918 for the whole decade.
Real quick, we got just about a minute. Kamala Harris wants to give middle-class families $500 every month. I think she said this yesterday. Quickly, is that as bad or is that as doomed as the 10% tax cut that Trump's talking about?
Well, it's doomed if you don't have a major shift and restructuring of the tax system in this country.
Okay.
You know, we've given $15 trillion to corporations, businesses, and investors since George W. Bush, and that included Obama. $15 trillion. No wonder we have such a bad deficit. $15 trillion and $7 trillion on wars that don't end in the Middle East. There's your deficit.
Got it.
You know?
Got
that's
it.
In a nutshell, and unless you turn that whole tax structure on its head again, there's no way you're going to afford to pay $500 for everybody.
Dr. Jack Rasmus, political economist and professor of economics and politics at St. Mary's College in Moraga, California. As always, Jack, thank you for coming on A Critical Hour.
My pleasure.
Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Supreme Court blocks deposition of Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross over census question, but lets challengers question other officials. The Supreme Court has blocked a deposition of Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross in a case challenging the decision to reinstate a citizenship question on the 2020 census. The action is a partial victory for the Trump administration that argued such a deposition of a cabinet official is, quote unquote, rarely, if ever, justified, end quote. It took five justices to grant the government's request. There was no recorded vote attached to last night's unsigned order. This is one of the early cases involving Justice Kavanaugh and his view of the executive branch and presidential power. Also, what does this say about the impact of the upcoming census? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. She's a civil rights attorney and advises the NAACP on federal judicial nominations and Supreme Court nominations. Leslie Prohl, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you.
So first, a little background. Wilbur Ross, as Commerce Secretary, reinstated the citizenship question on the census last March. Ross said the Department of Justice had requested the change in order to provide data to determine whether there were violations of the Voting Rights Act. Not since 1950 has the census asked respondents whether they are U.S. citizens. Challengers, led by New York's Attorney General and groups such as the ACLU, charged that the Trump administration's real reason for adding the question was to reduce the representation of immigrant populations. A trial in the case is scheduled to start next month. Some say, so what? Does this really matter? What's your take, Leslie Prohl?
Well, this is a really important issue. The census, as you know, affects representation in Congress in terms of counting people in certain districts and states. It also impacts how billions of federal dollars are spent around the country. So every decade, the Constitution requires the census to count all persons, not just citizens, all persons. And so the decision by Secretary Ross to include a question about citizenship is, as some have alleged in court cases, intentionally discriminatory against immigrant communities of color. This will reduce populations from responding because they'll be afraid to answer the question about citizenship. It will lead to inaccurate and false undercounts, which will then affect the representation in Congress and how the money is spent. So it's a critical issue. And the court's decision last night was really a stunner. For one, it was because the court rarely goes into discovery matters. This was not on the merits of the discrimination case brought by the Attorney General of New York. This was about whether to go forward with asking questions under oath of the cabinet secretary. So the very fact that the court got involved in this case to begin with is extremely unusual. The other thing I would note is you rarely have a cabinet official caught lying under oath to Congress about his motivation. Now, they came out initially saying that Secretary Ross had done this, had imposed the citizenship question, because the Department of Justice had wanted him to do so to protect voting rights. That ought to have been our first clue that something was going on, because this Department of Justice, the last thing they have shown they want to do is to protect voting rights. So the fact that he relied on that as the reason caused a lot of us to be very suspicious. Lo and behold, during some of the discovery after the lawsuits were filed, emails came out that it was Secretary Ross, Wilbur Ross, who had initially wanted to impose the citizenship question. So you have a cabinet secretary himself giving misleading and perhaps lying to Congress under oath about his motivation. And that's why the plaintiffs wanted to take his deposition.
Two things. One, to go back to something that you said at the top, which was that the impact of the undercount. Explain from a civil rights perspective why an undercount in the census benefits Republicans.
Well, if there are communities of color, immigrant communities of color, not responding, it means that they are not proportionally represented with respect to Congress as you're having redistricting battles once the new decade starts about who should be represented by people of color and trying to make sure that people are electing the candidates of their choice. There's also services and all of the types of federal money for public assistance, whether that's going to minority communities in need. If they are underrepresented, that means not enough money is going to those communities.
And also, doesn't the data show that the individuals in those underrepresented communities, when they do get an opportunity to vote, if they do get an opportunity to vote, that they have a tendency to vote for a Democrat.
That's true. And that's the political motivation.
That's the political motivation.
It's important to underscore here that a lot of people are saying they're doing this only for political reasons. The lawsuit alleges intentional discrimination. So it's core a civil rights case.
And it's also important to understand that there are those who are saying, well, since immigrants that aren't citizens can't vote, what's the issue? But the issue is also that there are immigrants that are here legally that do have the right to vote, that based upon the rhetoric from the president and current action by the administration will be reluctant to check that box because they just don't want the hassle, or they don't want the perception or the anticipated hassle.
That's right. And, you know, the Constitution, as I said, requires the census to count all persons. We have always been a country of immigrants, and the Constitution back that far anticipated this. So it said the census must count all persons, not just citizens. This is the way it has always been. And so for them to impose this additional requirement is very suspicious. And like I said, there's a lot of evidence that it is intentionally discriminatory.
You also talked about Ross being caught lying, and he, to your point, he initially said that he had acted in response to a December 2017 request from the Justice Department and that he had not consulted the White House. But to your point about emails, Ross later had to acknowledge that he had been exploring the idea before getting the letter from the Justice Department and that he had discussed this with Steve Bannon. So when you add Steve Bannon into the mix, that also has a nefarious taint to it as well, would it not?
Absolutely. There's also evidence that Secretary Ross had the conversation with Bannon through Kris Kobach, who is the Secretary of State in Kansas, who is really the chief purveyor of the voter fraud myth in the country, I would say. And so the fact that you have this duo, Bannon and Kobach, giving Ross advice on what to do with the census, no wonder the plaintiffs in this case wanted more discovery. This cannot have a good end for Wilbur Ross.
And it's important, since you brought up the name Kris Kobach, Secretary of State of Kansas, he is the creator of the cross-check program. And looking at the research of Greg Palast, we can see the impact of the cross-check program in terms of removing legally registered voters from the voting rolls in Arizona, in Michigan, in Ohio, in Wisconsin, and a number of other states. When you get Steve Bannon and Kobach working with Wilbur Ross, that's not a good outcome.
No. And, you know, this is only a temporary decision by the court. The court invited review of this. The Justice Department now has to indicate that it wants the court to hear this issue again going forward with the deposition on the merits. So it remains to be seen what justice will do. I imagine they will ask for review and then ultimately how the court will rule. What was interesting last night is because it's an emergency ruling, you can't tell who the justices were who joined the decision to stop the deposition. But you did have Justices Gorsuch and Thomas affirmatively saying that they were on that side of stopping the deposition. And in fact, they would have gone further and not allowed any depositions of any DOJ officials. And that the rest of the court said that it was okay to go ahead and depose a civil rights official about his knowledge and involvement in this. But we do not know exactly who the lineup was. Unfortunately, with this court, there's a good guess that it was 5-4. But I just wanted to point out that this is not the end of this issue, and that we're likely to see another ruling by the court if, in fact, they take this.
We understand, to your point, it took five justices to grant the government's request. There was no recorded vote. We know, to your point, how Thomas and Gorsuch went along. Using your insight and your professional wisdom, is it a stretch to think that Kavanaugh was part of the five?
No stretch whatsoever. This is somebody who made very clear in his 12 years on the D.C. Circuit and throughout his hearings that he favors broad executive power. In fact, a lot of us think that's precisely why he was nominated by Donald Trump, to protect him. And, you know, I think that he was very likely in the majority on this. You know, this is really a question of, is the Roberts Court enabled by Justice Kavanaugh going to run interference for this administration on voting rights, on this important census issue, on all matters involving elections? I mean, this is something to stop this deposition is really extraordinary. When you have the evidence that has been already collected by the plaintiffs about the motive of this cabinet secretary, you have the Justice Department trying to stave it off, saying, oh, high-ranking officials such as cabinet secretaries shouldn't be allowed to be deposed. They're busy. They're doing two important things. The flip side of that is, if there's evidence he was intentionally discriminating against immigrants of color and against a broad class of people. And so absolutely the right decision is for the court to allow this deposition to go forward. And if the court decides not to, I am hopeful that the plaintiffs can collect all the other information to show exactly what type of decision this was intentionally discriminatory and prove their case.
My guest is civil rights attorney who advises the NAACP on federal judicial nominations, Leslie Prohl. So, Leslie, looking at extrapolating forward a bit here, if Kavanaugh was one of the five and everything indicates to us that he was, what does that tell us going forward? Because there are those who said, oh, don't get so alarmed. You know, Kavanaugh may not necessarily be as conservative as everyone is thinking that he is, that once he gets that robe on, he will focus strictly on the Constitution and he will make his decisions based upon the law.
Well, you know, I think there's a real difference between hoping and the reality of the situation. I've been doing judicial nominations way too long to buy that. I mean, you have a 12-year record on the court. You know what he's like. You know what his jurisprudential thinking is like. There's always a possibility after someone is very criticized about their civil rights record and any other type of record, for that matter, in their confirmation hearing, that they're going to at least come out of the box trying to be more fair or just looking to be more fair. I doubt that that is Justice Kavanaugh. I think, as he told us in his second performance before the Judiciary Committee, what goes around comes around. And that just rings in my ears that he is not going to be someone who is at least trying to look fair at the beginning and proving his critics wrong, that he is going to join a Roberts Court, the majority, immediately on all of the issues that we had feared he would be bad on.
You know, I'm glad you brought up the point of what goes around comes around, because that's one thing, you know, for me to say to you, but it's a different thing for a Supreme Court nominee to say to the Senate during a confirmation hearing. That, in my humble opinion, that point right there ignoring his references to the cabal of the Clintons and everybody else that was behind this quote unquote attack on him, that statement right there should have disqualified him in a heartbeat.
Absolutely. And I actually think that's what, precipitated just former Justice Stevens coming out and a lot of the lawyers, the ABA wanting to take another look, the American Bar Association, about his temperament. That was just, unprecedented, unacceptable, just really nothing anybody had ever heard from a judicial nominee, from any nominee before the committee, let alone one to the highest court in the land.
So how do you think, since this is not final, your thoughts on how will they eventually hear from Wilbur Ross?
Well, I hope so. I'm always, hopeful that the court's going to do the wrong thing. We hope that it will until it doesn't. I think these are very strong cases. You have states and cities bringing these lawsuits about this census question in addition to civil rights organizations. It's a very strong, compelling argument that they've got. And I'm hoping with or without Wilbur Ross's testimony that they're able to prove the discrimination that I believe occurred here.
Leslie Prohl, civil rights attorney and advisor to the NAACP on federal judicial nominations. Thank you, as always, for coming on the Critical Hour.
Thank you so much.
All right, folks, you've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.